For much of the 20th century, the Irish men and women who served in the British forces during the First World War were largely absent from public memory in this country. Some who joined up saw it as a professional opportunity, and of course many of those who fought did so believing that they were helping to secure home rule for Ireland. But as Ireland moved towards independence, their stories were written out of Irish history. Among them were many students, graduates and staff of the National University of Ireland, at that time constituting UCD, UCC and UCG, now the University of Galway. In 1919, the NUI published a roll of honour listing those who had fought or died in the war. A recently published book expands on this roll of honour with fresh research and profiles of these individuals, exploring the role of medical graduates, chaplains and also the women who took part in the war effort. The book is called The National University of Ireland First World War Centenary Roll of Honour and Essays. I'm joined now in studio by the editors, journalist Ronan McGreevy and NUI Publications Manager Eimear Purcell. You're both very welcome indeed to the programme. Eimear, it's been in development, this book, for quite a while, hasn't it?
Yeah, it took a while. We started thinking about having it ready for the actual centenary in 2018. We contacted Ronan at that time to ask him. He had just published his Where the Firing Line Extends. And we invited Ronan to write. The idea was that he would write an introduction and we would just republish the honour roll. And then when Ronan came on board, he said, well, why don't I write some profiles and give more depth and background to these men? Then we decided, well, we wanted to honour our NUI women as well. So we invited Fionnuala Walsh to write a chapter on graduate women who had contributed to the war effort as well, just to have that balance. So it kind of kept growing arms and legs, for want of a better way of describing it. And we knew that Joe Deignan, Patrick Casey and Kevin Cullen had produced a book on Irish doctors who participated in World War One. So they were a natural choice then to contribute a chapter on NUI doctors who participated in the war, which they kindly agreed to do. They also included an awful lot of material on the advances that were made in medicine during the war and administering to those who were sick and injured at the war front. And then the last piece of the puzzle was Barbara McCormick. We found out about Barbara McCormick's work looking at the chaplains from Maynooth College, from St. Patrick's. So that's kind of how it grew as time went on. And then we kind of had other projects of part of our Decade of Centenary programme kind of leapfrogged over it. We had the pandemic. So it was a few years on in the making, yeah. And probably could have been a few more actually as well if I'd had my way. But anyway.
Well, it's here now.
Yeah.
Ronan, talk to us a little bit about education, university education in Ireland at that time, because we had, and you mentioned it in the book, we obviously had the land question, we had the national question, we also had the universities question.
Well, the universities question was a very important question that's kind of been forgotten about. As you know, you've written a book yourself about the land question and the national question. The third thing was to have a Catholic counterpoint to Trinity College Dublin, which was the dominant university on the island in the 19th century. There was a feeling that that there was no Catholic alternative to this. And this was an issue that in 1845, the universities, or in that decade, the famine decade, the universities of Queen's College, Cork, Galway and Belfast were
the godless colleges.
Yes, the godless college.
As far as O'Connell was concerned.
Yes, they were, but they were regarded as being not endowed by the Anglican faith. This issue rumbled on throughout the 19th century. UCD was founded in the 1850s, and there was a feeling still that there was no coherent Catholic university for the nationalist majority, particularly as in the late 1870s and 1880s, the issue of secondary school education for well-off Catholics became more predominant, and obviously there was more demand for universities as well. So it all culminated in 1908 with the National Universities, with the Universities Act, which is regarded as one of the sort of signature kind of achievements of the Irish Party in those years between 1900 and 1914. In which they became fully fledged universities, UCD, UCC, and UCG. So they became a sort of a Catholic counterpoint, as I said, to Trinity College. And it's in that context that the Act was only 6 years old when the war itself broke out.
And how then did the National University of Ireland respond to the war?
Well, it responded as most middle-class Ireland did, middle-class Catholic Ireland did at that time, which was to support the British war effort. There was a lot of consternation at that time about the Rape of Belgium, as it was called, particularly in August 1914 with the burning down of the library in Louvain. Louvain had an Irish college going back to the 16th century. So this is something that people, educated people in Ireland, felt very strongly about it. But all the three universities involved were, and the NUI, which was the governing body, were four square behind the British war effort. Students who agreed to participate in it were given leave of absence from their studies and they were allowed to take up their degrees afterwards. So it was, for most of the war's duration, the NUI supported the British war effort, and as evidenced by the fact that also in 1919 they published a Roll of Honour.
Now, James Connolly refers to economic conscription during the First World War. Obviously, conscription didn't apply to Ireland, but what he's referring to is people who basically literally couldn't afford not to go to war. That wasn't the pattern of the enlistment from University College Dublin, Cork and Galway, was it?
No, this is true. And there are 914 men listed on the NUI Roll of Honour. Every one of them had everything to lose by participating in the war. Remember, there was no conscription in Ireland. They didn't need to go. They were leaving behind, you know, their studies. A lot of them were medical students, etc., etc. But they signed up anyway. And I think they are evidence that we can't just lazily state, well, you know, all the people from nationalist background who joined up were joined up because, you know, for the money. Because in this case, they were actually risking everything, including their lives, to participate in the war.
And they would have had difficulty, or they did have difficulty, in getting commissions. You would expect that a university graduate or an undergraduate would have at least some opportunity to become at least a lieutenant in World War One.
Well, at that time, it's hard to envisage now, but only a small percentage of people actually ended up with a secondary school education. I think in the 1911 census in the UK, which included Ireland, it was something like 6 or 7%. So having had a secondary school education would have been regarded, you would have been regarded in the UK in general as being officer material. But that didn't happen in Ireland. The UVF, those who had been officers in the UVF and the 36th Ulster Division was formed, they became officer material. But that did not happen in Ireland for a long, long time. So some of those involved who had even university education had to enlist as privates to become non-commissioned officers as opposed to commissioned officers. And that was down to a belief widespread in Nationalist Ireland that that Nationalist Ireland was simply not trusted by the British authorities.
And one of the people who was, I think, most vehement about this was the officer commanding the 16th Irish Division, and that was General Parsons.
Yes, he was somebody who was regarded as a rather bumptious individual who, despite claiming everywhere he was asked that he was Irish and understood the country very well, in fact he didn't, and he created an awful lot of difficulties for John Redmond in particular, who had risked his neck, as we know, to support the British war effort.
Now, Emer, you, along with John Foley, curate some of the NUI archival material in the book, and one letter that you have is from Arthur Beveridge, who served in the Royal Army Medical Corps. And we'll talk to Ronan a little bit later about why there are so many. When you look at this list, RAMC, RAMC, nearly almost every second one, and sometimes three or four in succession. Tell me about Arthur Beveridge.
Well, Arthur Beveridge was from Rathgar in Dublin and his dad was town clerk of Dublin. He had a twin brother, James, who also served in the war, but unfortunately he was killed in 1917, which, you know, brings home the personal aspect of the war and impact on families, which we, you know, we tend to forget in the broader scheme of things. In NUI, we have the NUI archive and we also hold the archive of the Royal University of Ireland as well. So in that material, we've actually found a letter from Arthur Beveridge and he's writing to see if he can be awarded an honorary degree, an honorary science degree. So it's lovely to see those threads we have.
So he wasn't going to come back and finish his degree?
No, he's looking for an exemption to be awarded that. And a lot of the time they will cite their experience in the war. They'll cite the medical experience that they gained in that as well. And we have record, you know, he's listed as one of the ones for UCD who is awarded. They did give it to him, his BSc. So you see those threads coming through, which is one of the most interesting things about the project. These men mentioned in the honour roll, then we're finding evidence of them in our own archive as well. It was a lot.
Mm. And why were there so many, Ronan? Why so many NUI doctors becoming medics in World War One?
Because there was an oversupply of doctors in Ireland. I think there was over 3,000 Irish doctors who served in the First World War. I would imagine that's close enough to a majority of them. The Irish had a long service, long history of service, both in the British Armed Forces, but also in the Empire. So there's an awful lot of doctors who are listed here who would have served in places like India over the decades. And there was an oversupply of doctors for Ireland. And for a lot of them, it was simply a career opportunity. It was a good place to get experience. There was some adventure involved in it and all the rest of that. And the opportunities at home for a lot of them was very limited.
And of course, some of them didn't come back.
That's right.
Now, the names on the NUI's Roll of Honour, as first published in 1919, are all men, but many NUI women were also involved in the war. A chapter by Dr. Fionnuala Walsh looks into the lives of these women and their contribution to the war effort. Earlier, she spoke to our producer, Lorcan Clancy.
For a long time, these women, their stories were neglected and dismissed as being unimportant and secondary to everything else that was happening in Ireland at this time. But for thousands of women, the war had a very significant impact on their lives, not just in what they did at the time, but also in its transformative effects for decades afterwards.
When the war first broke out in 1914, the most common response here was support for the British war effort. Irish men had to decide whether or not they wanted to join the armed forces.
But women also had decisions to make and had to choose to what extent they were going to get involved and what the war might mean for their studies, for their opportunities in the years ahead.
Of course, not all women agreed on how to respond to the war. The suffrage movement, which included many women involved in universities, was divided. The Irish Women's Franchise League, for example, felt that the fight for voting rights should come first.
They published front covers saying, "Votes for women now, damn your war." While other suffragists felt strongly that the war was a crisis and that women had to do their bit to prove their worth as citizens by getting involved in Red Cross work or other activities to support wounded soldiers.
On the home front, women also had to step into various professions to replace absent men. Of course, those pursuing higher education could apply what they learned in fields like medicine.
And there was a lot of conversation at the time, a lot of discourse in the media about how women were on the upward move, that this was women's moment. The women were proving their work as citizens and that things could only get better for them. There's also the added element of the fact that as men were killed in the war, increasingly women had to consider a life without perhaps a spouse and to consider how they might make their own way in the world through their own financial means. And so education was an alternative route to perhaps to marriage and motherhood. The women who were students and graduates from the NUI at this time are very much exceptional women, a minority of women in Ireland at the time who had the opportunity to go on to third level. The numbers are growing, however, throughout this time. From 1908, once the National University of Ireland was established, women were admitted on equal terms with men. So, you know, within a period of 10 years, things are changing quite significantly for women. And these are, I suppose, among the earliest of the women graduates who are trying to make their way in the world as well after their studies.
Fionnuala Walsh has written extensively on the subject of Irish women and the Great War. She authored a book on the subject in 2020, but narrowing the focus to the NUI revealed some notable individuals. Of the 100 honorary war degrees conferred by the NUI, only two were awarded to women. They were both at UCC, Ellen Casey, a scientific assistant in the munitions department, and Iris Cummins, an engineer who took up munitions work at the Royal Arsenal in London.
And then after the war in 1927, she becomes the first woman admitted to the Institution of Civil Engineers in Ireland. So these are women who are very much using what they learned in their time in university to support their war work. Alice Perry is another engineering example. So she was in Galway, and she was the first woman in either Ireland or Britain to qualify as an engineer. And during the war, she served as a factory inspector in England and in Scotland. And this was increasingly important work due to the very dangerous nature of munitions work. Emily Anderson is another interesting woman from this time. So she graduated from Queen's College Galway in 1911, and she served throughout the war on the committee of the Galway Depot of the Irish War Hospital Supply Depot. And this is an organisation that gathered sphagnum moss from Irish bogland and made it into bandages due to the shortage of cotton wool. This became increasingly urgent as the war went on. And she was very active on the home front in that activity right up to 1918. And she became a professor of German in Galway in 1917, taking on a very senior position. But in 1920, she moved to London to work for the British Foreign Office. And in 1944, she received an OBE for her service during World War II.
While these two women, Emily Anderson and Alice Perry, don't appear on the Roll of Honour, they are honoured today at the University of Galway, with two buildings named after them in 2017, the Alice Perry Engineering Building and the Emily Anderson Concert Hall.
At the time, these women, they believed that what they were doing was important, that they were contributing what they could in a time of crisis, and they believed that they would be remembered for doing so. And I think it's about time that we give due recognition to their work.
And that was Dr. Fionnuala Walsh ending that report on NUI women and the First World War. Ronan McGreevy and Eimear Purcell are still with me here in studio. Eimear, there's also a chapter in the book on the Maynooth chaplains who studied at Ireland's National Seminary, one of whom inspired the cover of the book. Just tell us a little bit about the Irish chaplains in World War One who would have come through NUI.
Yeah, Barbara McCormick did great work. I think for the first time she brought together a list of approximately 60 graduates of St. Patrick's College in Maynooth who would have served in the war. Most of these men may have had some affiliation with some of the other constituent colleges of NUI and that they would have done their initial degrees there. One very interesting one, as you mentioned there, was Father Gleeson, who's from a Tipperary man. They would have ministered to the Irish Catholic soldiers, looking after their welfare, hearing their confessions. And that's what you see in the painting on the cover of the book. You see what's known as the last general absolution to the Munster Fusiliers at Rue de Bois by Fortuna Matana. You can see Father Gleeson. This is a painting of Father Gleeson, and he's given absolution to the troops, the Munster Fusiliers, actually, just before the Battle of Ober's Ridge. I think there was approximately 800 men there. And Ronan has actually been following up on that painting.
I mean, it's a very, very famous painting, but the original was destroyed.
Yes. When I wrote my book back in 2016, Wherever the Firing Line Extends, I did a chapter on it. The location at Rue de Bois has actually been found, and there's a plaque there with this painting on it. And the original painting was believed to have been destroyed in the Blitz in 1940, and that was the end of that. But I found out, discovered 2 years ago, that Matani had painted a second version, a copy of it, in 1919 for somebody, and that painting went on sale at auction with White's 2 years ago. And I managed to track down the gentleman who bought it, and he has very kindly lent it to the Cork Museum for the 100th anniversary of the unveiling of the War Memorial in Cork. And I think this is a very much loved painting. It's been in so many, you've seen it in so many people's houses over the years. It's hard to believe what I was looking at was actually the original, or as close as you're going to get, actually painted by Matania. So I think there'll be great interest in this when it's unveiled.
Now, there are some extremely celebrated names included in this list. I suppose the most celebrated is Tom Kettle. Tell me a little bit about him.
Well, Tom Kettle is, as you say, he's probably the last nationalist leader in Ireland. He was killed at the Battle of Jonchi in September 1916. He was a poet who wrote a very famous poem, To Betty, the Gift of God, which is probably the most famous Irish poem from the First World War. He was a lawyer, university lecturer, an MP, somebody who had all the intellectual gifts to have been a leader of a post-Home Rule Ireland. Somebody who was actually an Irish nationalist to his fingertips. He was in Belgium at the outbreak of the war trying to source guns for John Redmond, you know, John Redmond, the great constitutionalist. And that was at a time when it was touch and go as to whether or not the Home Rule settlement would be accepted and or whether Nationalist Ireland would have to fight to have it implemented. But he joined up the British war effort because he believed in the cause of small nations, and he had witnessed some of the atrocities the Germans had carried out in Belgium in 1914, and he was killed at the Battle of Jonchi. So he's probably the most famous graduate in the book. His name is on the Tiefval Memorial to the Missing in the Somme, so his body was never found.
And two very famous sons, I suppose you would say, both of whom survived the war. William Lombard Murphy, first of all. Who was his dad?
His father was the infamous or famous, call him what you want, William Martin Murphy, owner of the Independent newspapers, the villain of the lockouts of 1913. And again, this really illustrates the point that here is the son of one of the richest men in Ireland who has a medical practice in Merrion Square. He has everything to lose, and he joins up the war effort and spends the war in Salonika. So his father dies very quickly after the First World War, and suddenly Murphy takes over the Independent newspapers groups and his father's business empire. He dies then eventually in 1941, and he had a very, very distinguished life after the war.
William Archer Redmond, very, very famous name.
Yes, the son of John Redmond. The Redmond family are a fascinating family, as we know. So John, both John and Willie died during the war. John dies in March 1918. Willie is killed at the Battle of Messines Ridge in 1917, but William Archer survives the war. He served in the Royal Irish Regiment as well, and he becomes a TD in Waterford, and he holds that position until 1932. He's also founds a new party which holds the balance of power in the state in 1927. He eventually ends up joining Fine Gael, but he dies, like a lot of them did, suddenly in 1932 at the age of 46, and his wife Bridget inherits the seat, and she holds that seat until 1945. So, I mean, there's almost 100 years of service, public service from the Redmond family that ends with Bridget in 1945.
A name that might not be immediately familiar to people, but somebody who made a cultural contribution that will be very, very well known indeed, Arthur Colohan.
Yes, Arthur Colohan was a doctor, a sort of bit of a dilettante who ended up becoming a doctor, and he served in the war in India. He then immigrated to Leicester to work as a doctor, but he's best known as having written a lot of songs, but only one survives to this day, and that's Galway Bay. So Galway Bay was a huge hit for Bing Crosby in 1947, and obviously got a new lease of life 40 years later in the song Fairy Tale in New York, where the NYPD choir sing Galway Bay. But of course, there is no NYPD choir. But I think last year, the song was actually resurrected in New York. So it's a very famous song, Galway Bay. It was written about a brother of his who drowned in the bay when he was 19 years of age. And there's actually a plaque to Colohan in Leicester, but as far as I'm aware, there's none in his native Galway.
Well, we've been hearing the stories of some of the men and women from the National University of Ireland who took part in the First World War, including the composer of Galway Bay, Arthur Colohan. The book that we've been talking about is the NUI First World War Centenary, Role of Honour and Essays. It's published by NUI and Four Courts Press. My guests are the editors Rona McGreevy and Emer Purcell. Thank you both very much for joining us.
Thanks, Miles.
Thanks, Miles.
Just to hear again the ripple of the trout stream, the women in the meadows making hay, and to sit beside a turf fire in the cabin and see the sun go down on Galway Bay.
That's all we've time for on this evening's programme. Details of all our items as well as podcasts are available on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. My thanks tonight to Ruth Kennington on sound and our researcher Ian Kennelly. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.